Hello and welcome to the Emerald City Video Podcast. I'm your host, Russ Burlingame, and yes, I'm alone again. Naturally. And like last time I was alone, I'm talking today about comic books, although this time it's not so much about the high concept of a character like I did with the Superman thing. I'm talking about comic book movies. And there's a reason both that I'm alone doing this, and there's a reason that I'm doing it now. It's been a long, long time since I made the announcement on Facebook that I would be creating a series of short videos highlighting my 25 favorite comic book films of all time. One of those movies is back in the news this week, and I decided it was time to just rip that Band-Aid. No, it's technically an adhesive strip. I'm sorry, Johnson & Johnson, but rip the Band-Aid off and do something that I could actually, you know, put out there in the world. Anybody who knows me from the video store and somehow has not listened to any podcast before this, well, first of all, welcome. This is a very weird place for you to start, but God bless you. In any event, my day job is that I am the senior staff writer at comicbook.com. That's part of why so much of this podcast is dominated by discussions of big-budget blockbusters with a genre bent. I have to see these movies usually on the day that they're released for work, and so why not talk about them? Because I do this for a living, though, and because in the case of many of these characters, people who are close to me know I have kind of a long-term existing relationship with them that goes back years or maybe even decades. Friends and family who are relative novices to the whole comic book thing will often ask me for recommendations. Generally, I'm quick to point out that asking me for recommendations on comic book movies is really no better than asking me for my opinions on any other type of film, partially because years of working at video stores has conditioned me to offer personalized recommendations as much as possible, and partially because I know I have just weird-ass taste in films in general. I like what I like, I don't really apologize for it, and in many cases, the movies that a big chunk of the audience dislikes, I will like, and the movies that a big chunk of the audience likes, I will dislike. Civil War. That's kind of where the inspiration for this list came from. By doing this alone, it gives me the time to explain myself where I feel is necessary or merited, and by putting a definitive as-of-this-moment list out there in the universe, our listeners can contextualize comments I make later with this list, giving you a sense for whether my sensibilities are close enough to yours that my recommendations are helpful. Some scheduling difficulties with my co-hosts have made it impossible to get an episode done this week, at the same time that we've launched the Emerald City Video Patreon, asking people for money to offset hosting fees, equipment, and the like in exchange for perks, one of which is early access to episodes. So, yeah, if we don't have any episodes, it makes justifying patronage a little more difficult, and this seemed like one of the very, very few topics that I could do alone and still be interesting. With all that out of the way, a few ground rules. If you watch the introductory video, I went into this, promise it'll just be a couple of minutes. I'm not going to include anything on this list that did not get a theatrical release in the United States. So no Invasion crossover, no made-for-TV Doctor Strange, no Batman vs. Harley Quinn animated movie, none of that. None of the Lundgren Punisher or Roger Corman Fantastic Four either. Those might get discussed at some point down the line, and in the case of the Punisher, we actually did an episode that was Deadpool and the Lundgren Punisher. It was a lot of fun, you should check it out. But they won't be on this list. Spoiler alert, none of those items, with the possible exception of the Invasion crossover, would have made the cut anyway. I'm also disqualifying anything that has been released in the last calendar year. While the idea of removing direct-to-DVD TV movie and other kind of content is somewhat arbitrary and primarily designed to keep the sheer number of things that I have to consider for the list down, the date cutoff is more pragmatic. We had a pretty good year for comic book movies, but I don't want proximity to a good movie to make it feel like a great movie, and to elevate something on the list that doesn't really belong in my top 10. If this idea is popular and I end up, say, doing it again in 18 months, I would want to do so because something else joined the best of the best, not because some movie fell off the list after I realized I'd given it too much credit. And the last note here is, these are my favorite comic book movies. They are not necessarily the best comic book movies, although I would argue that in many cases they are indeed some of the best ever made. You can feel free to at me about why. Spoiler alert, Marvel Studios only has 2 movies on the list and The Dark Knight isn't here at all. I can give you some reasons that are good, some reasons that might be acceptable to criticism, and then I can give you some reasons that just boil down to, it's my list, these are my favorites. So, whether they're actually the best, or just the ones that are the most kind of rewatchable, here are my top 10 comic book movies, with the note that, yes, the top 25 daily video project is still on the way. Number 10 on the list is Red. Directed by Robert Schwenke and based on the comics by Warren Ellis and Cully Hamner, Red is a movie that elevates its source material. Well, maybe not elevates as such, but the movie is not a real true adaptation of the source material. And whether you think it's better or worse than the comic itself, the end result is that what makes this movie appealing is in many cases not present in the comic. So if you see this movie, fall in love with it, go buy the comic. The comic is a really good comic, but it doesn't feel that much like the movie you just saw. I like this idea. This is the same thing that makes some of the CW DC comic shows appealing to me, is the fact that they could kind of apply the formula of a property to the kind of thing that they want to make rather than trying to do it literally and probably failing, because let's face it, almost every comic book movie that tries to do it literally fails. Red is just a ton of fun. If you haven't seen it, it centers on a former CIA agent who is Red, retired, extremely dangerous, and he ends up in the crosshairs of somebody who's looking to eliminate loose ends from older agents. He, a couple of his senior citizen friends, and this girl he has a crush on, who has never met him in person before, but talks to him all the time on the phone because she works in veterans benefits and blah, 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 end up on this kind of crazy adventure trying to get themselves off of a kill list. It's a ton of fun. It has Bruce Willis and John Malkovich and Helen Mirren and, shucks, I can never remember the name of the woman who starred in Weeds, Mary Louise Parker. And if you haven't seen it, go check it out. It's like a 2010 movie, so it still looks pretty contemporary. It's not like kind of an 80s spy comedy where only half the stuff still holds up. It's a really fun kind of move through this strange universe that was set up. The villain of the movie is Carl Urban. Spoiler alert, this is not the last time you'll hear his name on this list. Number 9, Tim Burton's Batman. Now, as a kid, I grew up right at the point where I saw this movie about a trillion times. My brother was the Batman guy, I was the Superman guy, and this movie was never really my jam. Don't get me wrong, I enjoyed it, and I watched the hell out of it, totally on purpose as a 9, 10, 11-year-old kid. But, I don't know, there was something that never quite sat right with it for me, and I still to this day can't really put my finger on why I don't find it that enjoyable relative to some of the other things on this list. It was, however, kind of a turning point that started introducing comic book movies that mirrored the sensibility of the comics I grew up with and therefore were more enjoyable for me to sit through. In the case of, say, the Christopher Reeve Superman films, he did a spectacular job depicting that character, but it wasn't my Superman. My Superman was a little bit more angsty, not quite to the level of like Smallville or something, but that's part of the reason that I really enjoyed Man of Steel in a way that a lot of people didn't, is because I don't need my Superman to be 100% the Reeve Superman. But the Reeve movies aren't on this list, but Tim Burton's Batman is, largely because for my personal sensibilities, Batman is more rewatchable than the Reeve Supermans. I recently watched Superman 2, and it's one of those movies that isn't as good as people remember it, I think. I do enjoy the heck out of Superman the movie, and probably that would be my number 10. If one of these things fell off. But Batman, pretty much everybody knows the conceit of Batman. what Tim Burton brought to it was kind of a gothic look and feel that made the city feel very kind of quirky and eccentric, which I know, shock from Tim Burton. He cast Michael Keaton in the role. Nowadays, Michael Keaton seems fairly obvious for something like this because we've seen him as a supervillain and we've seen him as Ray Kroc and we've seen him in all these roles that require a lot of serious acting. But at the time, of course, he was primarily a comedic actor who did stuff like The Dream Team and Mr. Mom, and people were just like, okay, so Batman? But the Batman 89 movie made the kind of trend of superhero movies a thing that could happen. And it did so in part by investing lots and lots of casual people who didn't read comic books in Batman as a character and as a concept in a way that they hadn't been since the 60s. And it spoke to a new audience who didn't appreciate Batman 66 in the same way that our parents did. I watched the old Batman movie with the shark repellent and all that a bunch when I was a kid, but by the time I was like 12, I pretty much had stopped. And Batman 89 and the films that came after it were for my generation of people who couldn't watch that 100 times without getting bored. So, kind of a on the list with an asterisk. It's one of the ones that, while I don't find it as fun and enjoyable and sexy as some of the rest of the stuff on this list, it's impossible not to realize how special this movie was. And it's just beautifully shot, which is a thing that does count to me. In fact, this movie, I would say, probably took Logan's spot on the list, because Logan is too new. You know, it came out like 6 months ago. But it's just, it's a gorgeous, well-made movie that, oh, by the way, also happens to star a character I like. And that is kind of, Logan is cut from that same cloth. So don't be too surprised if this is one of those things where later on I rethink and I say, you know what? But for the time being, Batman. Number 8 is Captain America, the First Avenger. This was, for the longest time, my favorite Marvel movie, which is, I know, weird to some people because it's not super popular even among the Marvel hardcore, or arguably especially among Marvel hardcore, because it feels and looks and just generally acts differently than the other movies that are done in kind of the Marvel house style that was established by the first couple of Iron Man movies and carried through to the Avengers. Don't get me wrong, I have no problem with Marvel's house. Well, I enjoy the films. I do have a problem with the house style in the sense that now that it's become a house style and we've had done like 15 movies that look and sound and pretty much exactly alike, the Marvel movies that are on this list are the ones that look and act differently. And the first one of those is Captain America, the First Avenger. I don't feel like I need to give a plot synopsis for the First Avenger because I feel like pretty much everybody in the universe watches the Marvel movies. But just in case, this is a World War II kind of period picture that deals with Captain America has a kind of romantic subplot that obviously has to end in kind of tragedy because we know eventually he's going to pop up again in the future and the woman will be, you know, in her 90s or something. But along the way, you know, Steve Rogers is this guy who can't qualify for military service because he can't pass a physical. He agrees to be part of an experiment to make a super soldier, which is successful, making him kind of the perfect specimen of masculinity. And then a Nazi shoots the scientist responsible for it, and Steve is the only person who ever gets kind of super soldiered. And it feels like an update of the Christopher Reeve archetype in the sense that you have a character who is good for good's sake, and there's no moral gray to him at all in this movie. They play with that a lot in the sequels, and while I think that Winter Soldier is a great film, it is not one of my favorite movies to watch because I feel like some of the things that make it a great film also make it punishing to watch again and again and again. But The First Avenger, not the case. Every time I watch it, I enjoy it. It's one of those films that, you know, you can't go wrong with a superhero who punches Nazis. One of the reasons I'm super looking forward to the Crisis on Earth X event that the CW shows are doing soon. So, absolutely, if you are not a person, if you're one of the handful of people who have been kind of studiously avoiding the Marvel films or who don't make it your business to run out and watch every single one, I would highly recommend checking out Captain America: The First Avenger. This one has a feel that kind of goes with The Rocketeer, which was directed by Joe Johnston, the same guy who directed Captain America: The First Avenger, or with, say, Warren Beatty's Dick Tracy movie from 1990. If you liked either of those, you'll definitely like The First Avenger. Number 7, Deadpool. And this is a weird one because it already hasn't aged that well. I think that Deadpool kind of perfectly captures the character. And that's great, and it's amazing to watch the first time. But a lot of its appeal comes from irreverence. And in some cases, that irreverence doesn't translate into rewatchability. Rewatching it, some of the jokes don't play the same when you're not surprised by them. This is why I think The Simpsons tends to age better and have more long-term cultural staying power and more cultural cachet than, say, South Park, which is also long-running and also really funny and created by obviously talented people. But so many of their laughs are like shock laughs that over time they've worn the sharp edges off of television's culture. And so they're part of the reason that they don't age well, because they, as a cultural force, have helped to weather down the thing that made them interesting. So I think that the reason that The Simpsons tends to age a little bit better is because they rely on a different sensibility and a different sense of humor that's less reliant on shock. Same thing with Deadpool. It would be higher on this list if not for the fact that by the third or fourth time you watch it, you're nitpicking stuff that I absolutely had no interest whatsoever in nitpicking the first time I watched it, because this movie was just a delight. But it was, you know, very funny, very violent. It's an R-rated superhero movie where it's R-rated not because it's super violent, although it is, but because the main character has the world's foulest mouth and walks around, you know, making pornographic jokes, and there's a lengthy sex montage, and if none of this sounds good to you, you will not like Deadpool. My wife, for instance, loved the ads for Deadpool, thought it looked incredibly clever, didn't love the movie, she enjoyed it, but didn't have any desire to watch it again. But Ryan Reynolds is perfect in the role. I'm really looking forward to seeing how the second Deadpool movie plays and whether they can kind of evolve this character to a place that enhances the rewatchability. Also, they've got him working on the X-Force movie, where Cable and Deadpool and a bunch of their friends all have a superhero team, which is kind of a great, cool, fun idea, except that it's difficult to imagine Reynolds' Deadpool working in a live-action movie the way that he works in the comics. Like, part of the reason that it works in comics is because comics aren't limited to the same constraints of time and space that a movie has. And so you can have these kind of extended asides where he monologues to you about Ferris Bueller's Day Off or something. And there's nobody there to be like, what the hell are you doing? We're in the middle of a fight. Now, that can be played for comedy, and I have full faith that, like, Deadpool will probably use that joke at least once in the next couple of movies. But I'm based on how kind of pitch perfectly they played him in his own film, I'm super interested to see how he evolves in other films, to see if they can recapture that same magic without losing some of what makes Deadpool special. Number 6, Ghost World. Ghost World is an interesting film. If you rented at the video store, probably I recommended it to you at some point. It is the first comic book movie that Scarlett Johansson ever starred in, which is kind of a neat thing, considering now she's done, I think, 38 of them. It stars her and Thora Birch, who, if you remember Thora Birch, then you're probably within 5 years of my age. She was, like, one of the hot it girls around the turn of the century. She was the daughter in American Beauty, she did Ghost World, and I know she did like 7 other things that I just can't think of at the moment. She was kind of bargain bin Christina Ricci at the time when Christina Ricci was one of the most popular actresses going. But they star as these kind of this kind of mismatched pair of teenage girls who find one another, and in spite of the fact they don't have very much in common and their outlooks are very different, they kind of share a common cynicism and a willingness to laugh at the absurdities of kind of suburban, boring life. It's a really interesting film because the humor that drives so much of it doesn't carry through the second half when it starts to become a serious, like a more serious story. And so you get this movie that's about this friendship, and the friendship being challenged is actually the biggest conflict in the movie. Like, there's other things that are nominally conflicts in the film, but they don't really have stakes. There's another relationship that they share with Steve Buscemi's character, who's this, like, middle-aged man who is interested in them, but not romantically or sexually, or at least if he is interested in them romantically or sexually, he's not capable of expressing that because they, in spite of being like teenage girls, are clearly the ones with power in the relationship. But that relationship also at one point is threatened, and that becomes kind of a big plot driver. So this is a great piece if you like kind of quiet character pieces. There's a lot of weird eccentricities that are in here. Some of them come from the comics. Some of them come from the filmmaker, who's Terry Zwigoff. He also did Crumb, which is a documentary about this, like, underground comics icon, Robert Crumb, who did a lot of kind of quasi-pornographical stuff and things like that. But in any event, Zwigoff brings a lot of his own personality to this movie. You can also see he did movies, I think he did Art School Confidential right after this, which was another comic book adaptation from Daniel Clowes, who's the same guy who wrote Ghost World. The biggest takeaway from Ghost World, I think, was this sense of kind of over-the-top absurdist humor that would become a big, big part of popular culture over the next 5-10 years, which felt kind of ahead of its time when this movie came out in, you know, I want to say 2001 or something. It's also a movie that's just chock full of indie darling kind of character actors. Ileana Douglas is in it. As I said, Steve Buscemi's in it. There's a bunch of people who you'll see in this movie who you're like, oh, it's that person from that thing. And they're all really good in it. And being good in a movie that asks you to do incredibly absurd things and to say incredibly absurd things, but while doing it, delivering it in kind of a M. Night Shyamalan deadpan kind of delivery, it's a very difficult balancing act, and this movie carries it off really well. Number 5, and this is where I start getting in trouble with comic book people who aren't me, Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice. Yes, really. Now look, Batman v Superman is one of those movies that has been dissected to death, so I'm going to primarily not talk that much about it, although I feel like the last handful of times I've talked about it on the podcast, I've kind of deferred, so I'm going to at least touch on some of the things that appeal to me about it. First of all, I really like Zack Snyder's visual aesthetic. I'll talk about that more in a minute. But I like basically every movie that he has done in terms of a look. Even movies that the content doesn't appeal to me that much, I think that he has a really good eye. And so a movie like 300 or like his Watchmen adaptation or even Sucker Punch. Sucker Punch is a great example of a movie that like did almost nothing for me except for the fact that if you turn the sound off, it's gorgeous to look at. But Dawn of Justice is a beautifully shot movie that really is enhanced by, you know, shooting on the red cameras and in a larger format and all of these things that kind of big budget blockbusters are doing as almost a status symbol now. A lot of the people who are directing these films have only kind of a rudimentary technical knowledge of how to make those things look cool. And I think that Zack Snyder is really good at making them look cool. Now, yes, there is a lot of style over substance that goes on in pretty much all of his movies, and looking cool is not exactly the same as being good, but I also would argue that this movie is a lot better than it gets credit for in just the sheer objective, it's a good movie kind of way. One of the problems that both critics and audiences had with this movie is that the theatrical cut has some serious structural editing problems. This is true, I'm not going to argue it. I will say that I still enjoy the theatrical cut a lot more than most people did, but it was a flawed movie from a technical point of view, and I don't know if that comes down to Snyder, I don't know if that comes down to his editor, his cinematographer, who was kind of behind the wheel when some very bad decisions were made. But I will acknowledge up front, yes, Batman v Superman, especially in the theatrical cut, has some really wonky editing choices that make the film poorer and harder to rewatch. That said, I haven't watched the theatrical cut since it was in theaters. The ultimate cut, which is slightly longer and reworked and re-edited, is essentially Zack Snyder's director's cut. He had a longer unrated cut of his Dawn of the Dead movie, and Man of Steel didn't have a longer cut, but he did have like an extensive commentary track where he talked about these things. He very much likes to have a relationship with his audience where he can sit there and tell you, this is what I wanted this movie to be. And in some cases, that comes out as a longer cut. In the case of Watchmen, there were two longer cuts. There was a director's cut, which was essentially 20 minutes longer than the theatrical cut. And then there was an ultimate cut, which was his director's cut, plus also the animated footage from the Watchmen Tales from the Black Freighter animated movie. If you don't know what any of that means, the Tales from the Black Freighter stuff, don't sweat it right now. Not worth talking about. We'll get into that, because I'm sure at some point we'll be talking about Watchmen down the line. But the ultimate cut and the theatrical cut have enough kind of shared DNA that I'm just going to talk about the movie as a movie. You can probably assume that whatever I'm saying because I remember the ultimate cut. Although I did go see the theatrical cut like 4 or 5 times in theaters over the life of the time that it was there. I had actually one of those ultimate tickets that Regal does for usually like $100 that I got for less than that for free because it was my job. But The movie itself is deceptively simple when you think about how the poor editing choices made it seem incomprehensible to a lot of people. I don't have as hard a time explaining the plot as a lot of people do. Essentially what happens is that at the beginning of the movie, Lois Lane is conducting an interview when she is essentially held captive by a local warlord in Africa. When Superman swoops in to save her, there are political ramifications that come out of the kind of collateral damage that happens. And there are congressional hearings into whether Superman is kind of a menace to society because he acts without any formal authority and nobody can really stop him because he's Superman. When that happens, the congressional hearing is bombed. And there are significant casualties there. Superman blames himself and kind of gets all mopey and emotional for a little while. Meanwhile, we as the audience discover that Lex Luthor was responsible for the bombing as well as for setting up the situation in Africa at the beginning of the movie, and that all of this is part of a grandmaster plan to get him access to the corpse of General Zod, the Kryptonian supervillain who died in Man of Steel. Spoilers. So that he can build essentially a living bioweapon with which to try and kill Superman. He ultimately... Well, we'll leave it at that. But the next movie in this kind of universe is Justice League chronologically, although obviously Wonder Woman came up between the two. Wonder Woman being set in World War I means that there was very little fallout from the events of Batman v Superman in that movie. But I thought that Henry Cavill is a fantastic, fantastic Superman. He is not given enough to do in these movies, and I think that that's going to be an issue that will be resolved, hopefully, in Justice League, because I really want to see Henry Cavill at his full Superman. That said, I do know that Henry Cavill's favorite Superman story of all time is my favorite Superman story of all time. That's the Doomsday Death and Return of Superman kind of arc. And the fact that he got to do Doomsday in this movie certainly energized him, I think. And you could see, especially in the action stuff, he's much, much better at the action stuff in Batman v Superman than he was in Man of Steel. Speaking of which, number four, Man of Steel. Yes, I really, really like a lot of Zack Snyder's Superman. I'm going to get the last thing out of the way first, especially because I already spoiled it. Yes, Superman kills someone in this movie. No, I don't like that. However, it doesn't bother me on the level that it bothers a lot of people, especially a lot of comic book fans. I can't really explain why, other than the fact that within the kind of narrative framework of the movie, it felt like it made sense, and I tend to do a pretty decent job, I think, of judging these things on their own individual merits. But in any event, the death of Zod did not totally put me off Man of Steel or Zack Snyder or, you know, take your pick. What I really liked about Man of Steel is the fact that it explored the idea, and this is something that they're dealing with in the comics right now, that even if your kid is Superman, you still have that thing. Like, they're still your kid. And so part of the reason Jonathan Kent is not as good a parent, or at least is as not as good as Pa Kent, as he has traditionally been depicted in other media, is because Kevin Costner's Pa Kent is a father first and Superman's dad second. And there's, I think, something to be said for exploring that. There's a problem inherent to the Man of Steel, Batman v Superman, DC Extended Universe kind of thing that we can talk about a little bit here, which is these are massive $200 million movies that are meant for the largest possible audience, and to many people, they represent the definitive characterization of these properties, characters, things, for whatever period of time they happen to be the dominant one. In the case of both Batman and Superman, there are other versions currently on the media, or on the market, even in the live-action sphere. Gotham is a totally different take on Batman, plus you're going to have these weird solo movie things where, like, the Joker's going to have his own origin movie, and presumably Batman will be in that. There's reports that you're going to see a, like, Gotham by Gaslight or some other live-action movie down the line that won't be in the context of the DC Extended Universe. And, of course, when you look to Supergirl, Tyler Hoechlin is playing just a damn good, bright, sunny Superman in the vein of the Christopher Reeve model. So while I understand that for a lot of people it's a problem that kind of Zack Snyder's controversial take on these characters is the quote-unquote definitive take of the moment, I kind of feel like it's not. I mean, the Superman on Supergirl is phenomenal. I would be seriously tempted to put the two-part Superman introduction, like, mini-movie from last year's Supergirl premiere on this list. It was that much fun. It was just joy. And there are, you know, something like 3 million people a week who watch Supergirl per the overnight ratings, and then another twice that on the Live Plus 10. And then it goes to Netflix, and God knows how many people watch it. So Tyler Hoechlin's Superman is definitely there for people who want that Superman. I think that a lot of the controversy that swells up around the Snyder movies boils down to, this is not my Superman. And my fundamental problem with that is, it's still a pretty legitimate interpretation of Superman's mythology. It's a beautifully shot and beautifully performed group of movies. And at the end of the day, it not being your Superman is fine, because your Superman's still there. Superman is one of my favorite fictional characters of all time in any media. I came into comics as a little kid, and I basically didn't read any comic regularly until 1992. Like, I would read comics all the time, but it was just whatever I could get my hands on. I didn't start actively purchasing a book until the Death of Superman story happened. And then I read Superman from 1992 until 2000. And then from 2000 until 2015, they didn't publish an ongoing Superman story that appealed to me for a long enough period of time that I would actually become a regular reader again. At no point did I be like, oh, screw all these guys because it's not my Superman. Well, yeah, I did. When I was 20 years old and I was coming off of 10 years of being a reader, I did piss and moan about, like, Straczynski and Ed McGuinness and those guys, Jeff Loeb and Ed McGuinness and those guys, and so, yeah, I did. But I was 20, and I was immature, and that was not a reasoned critical opinion. Again, with Man of Steel, there are some legitimate criticisms I can see. There's some weird characterization, especially, you know, as I talked about with Pa Kent. But I think it's a beautifully shot movie. I think it's a very thoughtful movie. I think that the idea of doing Superman as essentially a refugee story is obviously super prescient. It wasn't done while we were dealing with a refugee crisis, or at least not on the scale that we are now. But it certainly feels present to this day, which is funny because I feel like Zack Snyder is one of those guys who's kind of almost aggressively apolitical, where I feel like I can see right-wing themes in a lot of his movies and left-wing themes in a lot of his movies, and it just kind of depends on what you want to read into it. But Man of Steel is one of those movies that I think in the long run a lot of people are going to take a look back and say, like, you know what, this was a lot better than we gave it credit for. That's probably going to be true of Batman v Superman as well, but A, the fact that the expectations for that were so high that for a lot of people it's always going to be a bomb no matter what you do. And then B, the fact that the theatrical cut just had such structural editing problems, I can understand why people do not like Batman v Superman. I have a much harder time understanding why people genuinely think Man of Steel is a bad movie. I can understand why you don't like it as Superman. But I like it fine as Superman. You know, the death of General Zod is a thing that happened in Superman 19 when I was 8 years old or whatever it is, and became a major, major part of his backstory going forward. And so it was something that was revisited frequently when I was a Superman reader in the 90s. So, yeah, Man of Steel, I have a lot of really, really positive things to say about it. I have very few negative things to say about it, and it doesn't even have the same kind of technical deficiencies that Batman v Superman did. I think it's just a damn good movie, and I'm really surprised at the level of vitriol that's directed at it. Number 3, Dread 3D. Yeah, I'm getting violent. I'm getting a lot of dark, violent movies. I got Deadpool, I got Batman v Superman, now I got Dread. I don't know, man. I didn't put The Crow on here. I didn't put Blade on here. Dread is... the character of Judge Dread in the comics is essentially a fascist, and the violence in the book is absurdly over the top, and it's played for very black comedy in a lot of the cases. Dredd, while he is the hero and while you do root for him, he is objectively not a really good, objectively good in the Christopher Reeve sense, good guy. And I think that this movie captured that really well. And I think this movie captured the kind of anarchic sense of what Dredd means to a lot of people in terms of he's this off-the-wall, ultra-violent, kind of rah-rah, you know, masculine archetype. And when they did the Sylvester Stallone movie, they tried to tackle some of the more science fiction elements of the Dread mythology, and they failed. There were a lot of reasons that it failed, but they failed. And with Dread 3D, they didn't have the New Line Warner Brothers movie behind it, or money behind it, excuse me. They had a lot less to deal with, and so they needed to make a version of Dread that was both better than and significantly cheaper when adjusted for inflation than the previous Sylvester Stallone outing. And Carl Urban was a godsend because they found a guy who loves Judge Dredd. And so they found a guy who got the character right away, who always wanted to be this character, who understood you can't take the helmet off, who already in his mind had a Judge Dredd he wanted to play because he'd probably been doing it since he was a teenager while he was screwing around with his friends. Urban's performance, Lena Headey's performance, and Olivia Thirlby's performance are all just really, really good. And frankly, everything else is just a set piece. Even the other characters are just there to be chewed up and spat out by your three leads. And that, they do it masterfully. I mean, it's a beautifully shot movie. It's one of the very, very few movies I've ever seen where the 3D genuinely enhanced the experience. And it's the kind of movie that I understand why there's still people all these years later bitching about the fact that there's no sequel. Because I would love to watch these same people try to approach Dredd again. And I really, really hope that this live-action Judge Dredd TV series that's being developed, I hope the rumors are true and that Carl Urban really will take the role. Because even if it's not all the same folks and it doesn't have the same kind of powerful vision that Dredd had, I think at a bare minimum, seeing him back in the costume would be just a boon. Probably. Yeah, I'd be willing to say that of all the characters on this list, Urban is right up there as possibly the best performance of anybody on it. Probably Ryan Reynolds as Deadpool, and maybe one other thing that I haven't mentioned yet, but yeah, I mean, just an incredible, incredible performance, a really enjoyable movie, and I could just, it's the kind of movie that you can watch a million times, because it's got that kind of diehard thing of just like, most of it is just cool action set pieces, and you walk from one to the next to the next to the next, and they escalate and escalate and escalate, and then the movie ends. And if you actually slow down and pay attention to it, the performances are great, the set design is great, the cinematography is great, all of that's great. But if you want to just put it on for background noise, like, totally, totally works. That's something I can say differentiates it from, say, Man of Steel, where it's a movie that just begs for you to pay attention to me, pay attention to me, pay attention to me. I'm doing clever things with colors, I'm doing clever things with lens flares. Dredd is intensely enjoyable to just kind of put on and kind of watch with one eye in the same way that, say, Captain America the First Avenger is, or Red. Number two, Guardians of the Galaxy. And yes, Guardians of the Galaxy is my favorite superhero movie of all time. That might seem silly, considering that so many of my movies on this list have been super dark and not so fluffy. But the Guardians of the Galaxy takes the Marvel formula and manages to make a truly incredible film experience out of it. Because, like I said with Captain America the First Avenger, the bones are there and the bones are sturdy, and the thing that you have to do to make a truly great Marvel movie is to know where their house style should begin and should end, and where your own personality needs to come in. And holy shit, James Gunn's personality just seeps through every pore of both Guardians of the Galaxy movies, and the Marvel Universe as a whole is so much richer for it. All the performances are great, but it's really the world building, it's the way that Marvel's cosmic universe is kind of designed and executed. It's the use of music, and not just the pop music, but the score of this movie is just really well done. I mean, there was that video out there a while back that was the Marvel Symphonic Universe, and it basically said that because Marvel uses super safe, super boring composers, that you can't really, like, you can't remember what's the theme for Iron Man, what's the theme for the Avengers, compared to, say, you know, Danny Elfman's Batman or John Williams's Superman. But I can remember the score from Tyler Bates's Guardians of the Galaxy score. And Tyler Bates in general is a great composer for this kind of movie. Tyler Bates also works with Zack Snyder a lot of the time. He composed Watchmen. And it's one of those things where if you don't remember most of the score, it's probably because he's setting the mood perfectly and he's not being conspicuous. But the Guardians theme is one of the very few themes from the Marvel movies that I can remember. And similarly, almost every place that this movie takes you, you mention the name of that place, and I can immediately bring it to mind in my head. In most of the other Marvel movies, unless it's like the Helicarrier, that's simply not the case. Like, they all bleed together in a way, and it's kind of like, oh, they all take place in the Marvel Universe, which is great, but there's not a lot of visually distinctive stuff that's going on. And I think that prior to Guardians of the Galaxy, there was some question of, can you be cool and clever and visually distinctive and subversive and still work as a Marvel movie when the Marvel, brand is so much not all of those things? And Guardians of the Galaxy was the movie where they said, absolutely. And I think that so much of the success that Marvel is having right now with directors like Taika Waititi or Waititi, the guy who did Thor Ragnarok, and the Russo brothers doing Civil War and Infinity War, all that kind of stuff, comes from the success of Guardians, where they were able to say, you know what, maybe we can give the director some power. Because I think in the past you saw Jon Favreau obviously is an incredibly skilled director, obviously really good with the tech stuff that so many directors are bad with, in terms of what he was able to do in Iron Man, then what he was able to do on The Jungle Book. But, he's kind of boring visually. And he clearly didn't challenge Marvel on a lot of creative choices. And that's kind of the general gist I got, is that Marvel hired guys who were relatively cheap and easy to work with for a long time. And then James Gunn comes along and it's like, oh, now we're hiring guys who are interesting. And to me, that's part of why I like the Zack Snyder movies so much, and that's part of why I like, things like Deadpool and Logan and First Avenger and Ghost World and Dread, because these are all interesting movies. And I would almost rather somebody take a big swing and miss than somebody play it safe and they just deliver the 20th consecutive just fine, thank you, pass the salt movie. So Guardians of the Galaxy, aside from some minor wonkiness in terms of the villain is crappy, but that was a thing that Marvel was going through for a while right around that time, is that all their villains were kind of crappy. But outside of the villain being crappy, I thought that it was an incredibly well done movie. I thought that narratively it was great, because it's one of the very few Marvel movies where the characters get some kind of arc. And then obviously there's a larger arc going on through the trilogy, kind of like what they did with Tony Stark back when that was a thing that happened, and that they actually treated solo movies like solo movies. But within the context of Guardians of the Galaxy, if Guardians of the Galaxy 2 had never happened, that movie was satisfying. And that's something that Marvel was really struggling with at that time. And so it was like one more thing where Guardians came in and did something right on the first try that Marvel had been really struggling with. So, if you're a person who isn't super into superhero movies, and for some reason you are listening to a 45-minute podcast where somebody talks about superhero movies, Guardians of the Galaxy is the one to start with. It is packed with the kind of love for the source material and love for film, and just everything about this movie just exudes the enthusiasm of the people involved with it, be it James Gunn or the cast, or clearly Marvel at some point figured out that they had something very special going on. And the whole movie just feels like everybody on the set was having the most fun of their entire lives. And that kind of infectious enthusiasm cannot help but be felt in the final product. And in an environment where so many of these movies are joyless. And I don't mean it in the, like, oh, this movie's so dark and, you know, it's joyless because not everybody's smiling. No, I don't mean it like that. I just mean, like, so many of them are very clearly, like, corporate-mandated endeavors that just exist to make money. And when you look at something like Dread, or when you look at Guardians of the Galaxy, it feels like somebody's student film. It feels like somebody's passion project. It feels like something that, like, that has no earthly business existing. And it does, and somebody spent an absurd amount of money to make it a reality. And there's something just genuinely remarkable about that. And you just wonder how it even happens. It's the kind of alchemy that you cannot predict. It's the, you can't make this happen. It just has to happen kind of through luck. Yeah, Guardians of the Galaxy. I think I'm going to watch it again when I'm done with this. Number one, my personal favorite comic book movie of all time. The thing that I have said many, many times, and that you can quote me as the comicbook.com's Russ Burlingame, is the best comic book movie of all time. Harry Elfont and Deborah Kaplan's Josie and the Pussycats. Starring Rosario Dawson, Tara Reid, and Rachel Lee Cook as Josie, Josie and the Pussycats follows a group of kids from Riverdale, because, yes, this is an Archie comic, who have kind of an underappreciated local band, and they are magically discovered by one of the largest record companies in the world. Everything goes incredibly well, and before they know it, they are the most famous band on the planet. And then they realize that there's way, way more going on than meets the eye. And again, very much like what I said about Guardians of the Galaxy, this is a movie where everybody here clearly was having an enormous amount of fun. You know, you listen to interviews with the talent and they say, this is the most fun I ever had in my career. On Tuesday, there was a 16th anniversary concert and screening because they're reissuing the soundtrack on vinyl for the first time ever. And it's interesting because the soundtrack actually went gold. It was a gold record. It sold 500,000 copies in the U.S. and 1,000,000 copies around the world, or whatever it is you have to do to get gold. And was a major commercial and critical success. Meanwhile, the movie cost about $40 million to make and only made about half of that back. It wasn't until, like, the home video market when people were able to really kind of sit down and take in all the Easter eggs and listen to the commentary and figure out, like, this was an incredibly subversive movie for the kind of movie that it was. I mean, this is a movie that came out in the age of, like, the Spice Girls movie, but was both embracing the kind of tropes and the visual aesthetic of those things, but also lampooning the content. So that, for instance, there's product placement in almost every shot everywhere in the movie. It's ubiquitous. And a lot of people said, you know, for a movie that's all about staying true to yourself and resisting the lure of kind of corporate America, that it was super hypocritical for them to have so much product placement. And they didn't get paid for any of it. This is the thing where they actually, there were certain things that they wanted in the movie that they couldn't get in the movie because they decided, like, we're going to have this commentary on, you know, the relationship between consumer culture and the music industry. And in some cases, there were folks that just weren't interested even at all. And so the three actresses who were in it were just bang on for what their characters both were and then needed to be. Obviously, the comics and the cartoon series from the 70s were very kind of surface level. These are not like superheroes that have elaborate soap opera kind of backstories. Most of the Archie stories are one and done. Or if they're recurring, then it's like a romantic subplot or something and almost nothing else. So this is not, they didn't have the same advantages that all these other movies that I've talked about did for the most part, where you have decades of backstory to fall back on. Or in the case of like Ghost World, you have an incredibly kind of thoughtful piece of source material that even if it doesn't have a lot of history, it's basically a good novel. Josie and the Pussycats basically had some character archetypes to work with and a high concept, and that was it. And they turned out this movie that is just astonishingly good. And I'm so glad that we now live in an era where it's getting appreciated. I remember a few years back, somebody wrote the first of what turned out to be many, many essays that were basically Josie and the Pussycats was ahead of its time. And I remember circulating that on social media and being like, yeah, somebody gets it. I love this movie. And it was shortly after that that I decided I want to do the Emerald City Video Podcast because I wanted to get together with people who liked movies and kind of force them to watch this thing and then talk about it, which is why when you look back at our very first episode, we did Star Wars: The Force Awakens because it was new and it was the thing that literally everybody was talking about. And we did Josie and the Pussycats. And even without me telling them ahead of time, like, this is what you're getting into, all three of the other guys in the podcast actually liked Josie and the Pussycats better than they liked Star Wars because it's a remarkable film if you actually watch it kind of for what it is. And part of the reason that it was ahead of its time is because very much like what I said about Ghost World, where it kind of embraced this sense of the surreal and the absurd that hadn't really broken into the mainstream yet. Josie and the Pussycats was very much like that. You know, one of the things that you get is you get a like an NSYNC slash Backstreet Boys kind of send up in this band called Du Jour, which there's like jokes built into jokes built into jokes because Du Jour is French for of the day, basically. And so you're sitting here going, this is the boy band of the day. But I remember the first time I watched it, the first time you see these characters on screen, they are singing one of their songs. And the song is called Backdoor Lover. And when you're 20 years old and you're watching a boy band sing Backdoor Lover, you immediately start making butt sex jokes. And within 15 seconds, I realized that my jokes weren't as good as theirs because the entire thing was a giant, elaborate anal sex song in the style of NSYNC. And it played on the fact that, like, kind of this toxic masculinity thing of like just accusing boy bands of being gay. And so that you have this thing where like the whole band has a song that's obviously about anal sex, and they have to skirt around the idea of like the homosexuality that's inferred by the audience, but not inferred by any of the people who are listening to them because they take the metaphors all at face value because they aren't actually thinking about the music. And that's the first scene of the movie. Like, that's before you even meet Josie. And so when people are like, oh, well, nobody got that movie, I'm like, how did you not get this movie? Like, how do you watch Backdoor Lover and then just go in and be like, oh, okay, I'm going to watch the Spice Girls movie now and expect that's what it is? It boggles my mind that it took this movie like a decade to really find the kind of audience that it deserved. And I'm super, super glad that it has. All right, folks, I'm going to cut it off there. You're going to hear a lot more of this stuff if you watch the videos. But if you don't watch those top 25 videos, then hey, here's the top 10. It's about an hour. I'm going to knock off, go to bed. I'm going to put this up on our site in the morning as an unedited rant, basically. And those of you who back us on Patreon can get access to it for 2 days, and then on Monday it will go out to the rest of the universe. So thank you for listening to the Emerald City Video Podcast. You can like, rate, subscribe, all that good stuff on Apple Music. And we'll be back very, very soon because we actually are recording a new episode on Sunday. I'm recording this on Friday. So basically expect that within a week of when you hear this, there's going to be a new episode of the Emerald City Video Podcast. And then next week is New York Comic Con, and I've got some exciting stuff that I've planned. I've got some really cool stuff. I'm there for comicbook.com, but I've got a handful of things that I want to do for Emerald City while I'm there. So expect in the next month or so, there will be a lot of episodes and a lot of fun. Thanks a lot. Spin around, jump back, take another look at yourself. You've been hiding.